Welcome to Behind the Headlines. This show is a roundup of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio live every Friday morning. I'm Roger McDonough. Well, today on the program, I think anyone could easily predict a good chunk of our show will be tackling the ongoing protests in Salt Lake City sparked by the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Also, Black Utahns ask for policy changes locally to address systemic racism. And we will also get to Utah's spike in COVID-19 cases. On the phone for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins is with me. Thanks for being here, Peyton. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Reporter Taylor Stevens, thanks for joining as well, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke, welcome to you, Robert.
Yeah, good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. The number is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also always tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Peyton Harkins, protests continue daily here in Salt Lake City, and you have been there witnessing history as it unfolds. But the last episode of this show, our weekly news roundup, was recorded on Friday, and so we need to get caught up. And so before we turn to the protests of last night and the night before and before that, we need to talk about Saturday night. So just for the record, there was a protest on Saturday. It actually wasn't the first protest in Utah over George Floyd's death, but it was the beginning of what came to be sort of a new reality for Utah's capital city, temporary or otherwise. Peyton, take us back to Saturday and into Sunday. First off, who organized that protest?
Yeah, so that started out as a Utah Against Police Brutality event. It was a car caravan, so the idea was sort of they were supposed to kind of show up in downtown and then stay in their cars and drive around kind of that public safety building there.
Right.
But from what I heard from people, there was just too many people showed up, you know, and so cars couldn't really contain them. So people kind of, you know, got out of the cars, started walking around and kind of being there, you know, on their feet, you know, and then it kind of just kind of blew up from there.
Right. And a sort of interest, I mean, yeah, it began the way that most protests do with people converging on a place to show numbers, to make a statement. They want to be heard. A sort of interesting part of this was the lack of police presence on Saturday, at least at first. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it felt a little bit eerie sometimes because you literally saw nobody. One of our photographers, Trent, he had his bicycle. And so while I was kind of in the mix of it with some other photographers, he decided to kind of ride out and do a perimeter just to see kind of what if any police response there was. And he came back and he saw nobody, you know. And so after things started happening, like with the car being flipped, which I'm sure we'll get to in due time,
yeah.
You know, I assumed police were, you know, the reason they weren't there was probably because they were coordinating on how to get there, you know?
Yeah, although the other suggestion is that it was a calculated decision to not be there so as to not create more confrontation by being there present as the agents or the organization, the sort of representatives of the organization that the protest was, you know, essentially protesting against. Some chaotic scenes, as you mentioned, a strange incident with a guy with a bow and arrow. Can you talk about that? What happened there?
Yeah, that happened. It was the police car had been flipped and set on fire, and everybody had kind of moved on from that scene, you know, down the street, kind of broke the windows out of track stations, and they went to the 7-Eleven that's nearby and broke the glass windows out of there.
Right.
And police showed up. And so when police showed up, it kind of pushed people from where they were congregating around this police car over to a different area. And I was not in that area, but that's when this guy, Brandon McCormick, apparently showed up, got out of his car. I've heard reports that perhaps he had like a machete or some kind of knife or something like that. But like I said, I didn't see it.
Right.
But then goes back to his car and gets this like a hunting bow and arrow and points it at protesters who then, you know, rush him. And then he seems to get beat up pretty good. The pictures I've seen, you know, he has blood running down his face.
Yeah.
And then flip his car and set that one on fire, too. And so my perspective, I was maybe, I don't know, like a less than a football field away. So I could see, you know, I see the you know, kind of rowdy, focusing around this area. And then you see just, you know, black smoke and flames just kind of erupt from this area. Wow. And I, you know, I just don't know what's going on. It was wild.
I skipped over, obviously, the in terms of sequence, the overturning of the police car and its burning.
Yeah.
And that was that a car that had been abandoned or left behind by police officers? Do we know?
Yeah, so the only indication that we've gotten from that I'm aware of is this PC statement, this probable cause statement for the guy who ended up getting, one of the guys who ended up getting federally charged in the burning. And so it says, and I didn't see this because you have to imagine, I mean, the crowd's huge and I'm a short person, you know, so it's like I was close by, but I, you know, I can't see over all those people's head. But what the PC statement says is that this officer was apparently driving through the area and then the protesters, I guess, stopped traffic. And so it says the crowd was, quote, increasingly hostile. And so he just abandoned the car and ran away. And so the car's, you know, running, and then I guess people just kind of took it, you know, took the moment for what it was and flipped it, you know,
at what
everything that came from that.
And is that the point at which police began to move in, Peyton? I mean, when did the police move in on this protest?
I want to say it was at least an hour or two after that, because I mean, people got their time with, you know, to do whatever they wanted around the car. I mean, people were climbing up on top of it, dancing, you know, raising their fists. At one point, a woman peed on it. You know, it's like people got their time with it. But it was actually, I want to say, 2 hours later, after people had kind of moved on from that scene and had moved on kind of to that 7-Eleven, that that police moved in. Like, I was on the corner by the 7-Eleven when I saw the first big, armored SWAT truck move down the street.
There was a lot of footage. I think most people know the aftermath of this. There was property damage, some broken windows and graffiti, and of course the burned police car. How did police react when they got there? And then, you know, just sort of generally, how did officials at the state and local level respond to this protest? And that's kind of two part, I think, in the immediate and then in the aftermath. Can you tell us that, Peyton?
Yeah, so I'll start with sort of what police did when they arrived on scene. It was a coordinated effort. Like you had mentioned that, you know, police were giving people their time, you know, didn't want to escalate tensions and stuff like that. But I think after the sort of the violence and the unrest got to a certain point, you know, then they started planning. And so they came in a big swarm, basically, just right down that street where the police car was, just a big line of them, you know. And I think that kind of spooked people. They started running around because, you know, police show up and you're a protester and you don't really, you know, you get spooked. But they went down that road. And the thing that stands out about when they first arrived on scene was this video that I think ABC4 captured. It was in their live shot where police arrive on scene. Something happens and they end up just pushing down this elderly man who was down in this area, which was really just kind of the outskirts of the protest at the time. It seemed, I don't know, didn't seem like a good thing to do. And then they just kind of, you know, set their position there and then made a perimeter and just kind of kept pushing until they eventually got everybody out, you know, several hours later. But as far as, you know, how people reacted at the time, I mean, I was on the ground that day when I learned that Herbert had activated the National Guard, you know, Governor Herbert. And then Salt Lake City Mayor Erin Mendenhall, she set the 8 p.m. curfew while I was out there. And, you know, these were things that I don't think people, you know, if you weren't on your phone, if you were actively participating in the protest, I don't think you would have even known, you know. And I think at the time Herbert put out a statement, you know, saying that most people, including him, think that what happened in Minneapolis, George Floyd's death, was despicable. But he said, what I've seen in the past few hours is that it has gone from a peaceful protest to criminal behavior. And Mendenhall, you know, kind of echoed that in her comments that night.
Right. And enacted a curfew.
I
want to kind of turn to the aftermath as well. And Taylor Stevens, maybe if you're up to it, I'll bring you in on this as well. I mentioned the property damage and the windows and, you know, and the graffiti and so on. You went out and surveyed the damage the day after during the cleanup in the aftermath of this protest. And your article starts with the cleanup of a public art installation. And it was this piece of art that almost seemed to be waiting to be repurposed for a protest. Can you tell us about the cleanup and what it looked like? And maybe you can start with the bronze sculpture that I am alluding to here.
Yeah, definitely. So this bronze sculpture, as you mentioned, it's outside Salt Lake City's public safety building. So if you're familiar with that area, Washington Square near the library, just across the street. And this sculpture is sort of a symbol of the duty that emergency responders, police officers have to protect and serve their communities. And obviously during this time when so many people are talking about use of force by the police, the death of George Floyd after an officer knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes, protesters repurposed this sculpture during the events of the protest Saturday night. They stained it with streaks of bright red paint, almost looking like blood in these two open hands that are kind of outstretched near the building. And it was a very evocative image. I mean, I went out on Sunday afternoon and it was still there, hadn't been cleaned up quite yet. You know, there's glass on the ground from where the windows had been shattered at the public safety building. Graffiti is still up, still eggshells on the ground from where protesters had thrown eggs against the windows. And, you know, this image, I think, really highlighted the efforts of protesters and kind of the goal of protesters to call attention to this cause. And I think that was lost a little bit in the coverage of, you know, nationwide has focused a lot on the property damage and the violence for good reason, but this was sort of a kind of indicator of what the underlying cause was.
I also want to bring Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke in on this. And Robert, you wrote about the protests and their aftermath and mainly about the sort of changes that protesters are asking for. And part of what you wrote is that it's time for policymakers to stop saying, you know, we understand your frustration and anger, but, and you wrote that, you know, you don't understand that, I don't, we can't comprehend that frustration because we haven't lived it. Most of us in the state haven't even lived near it. Can you just talk about your perspective on how this all unfolded?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that kind of gets lost in some of the, you know, in some of the violence that transpired that evening was that for 4 hours, this was a peaceful protest up at the University of Utah, or up at the Utah State Capitol. And you know, so that kind of gets overshadowed a little bit. There were thousands of people there, or at least 1,000 people there, who were demanding change. And so I think that needs to be the focal point. But yeah, I mean, we hear over and over that, you know, I understand your anger. And we live in a state where 1% of the population is Black. And it's hard for people who aren't Black to understand sort of the day-to-day struggle, the reality of what they have to deal with. And then these recurring, all too frequent incidents of police violence, of violence against Black people, whether it's vigilante violence, like we saw in Ahmaud Arbery's case, Breonna Taylor's case, you know, we can't comprehend that. And so we don't understand it. It's hard to wrap our heads around the violence that occurred that night, but it's also, we shouldn't dismiss the anger that's there. And you know, it probably could have been worse. It was unpleasant to watch. I'm not a proponent of violence as a means of protest, but I think, I think it's also something that it's hard to dismiss the anger when for years people have tried to do everything else, organize, yeah, advocate, vote, you know, and these things just haven't worked. And so, you know, the Martin Luther King quote we've heard over and over in the past week or two, a riot is the language of the unheard. These people aren't being heard, and hopefully that changes after this week. Although there's not a whole lot of reason to think it will, given the history that we've seen in the past when these types of incidents occur. And just, you know, I think pivoting beyond Saturday, we've seen protests in downtown Salt Lake every night since,
right.
And they've remained peaceful, and they've remained, I think, hopefully constructive, although, you know, they also raise some concerns about the spread of COVID and when you get that size of a gathering together and that close proximity.
Right. All of this, of course, is playing out during a pandemic. Peyton Harkins, we haven't gotten to that part yet. You've been to these protests since, and many of the protesters want some big systemic changes. You've been following these subsequent protests, and you know we haven't even begun to touch on those. What kind of actions do protesters want to see, other than that first and foremost we all demand change of some sort? What are the changes that they're asking for?
Yeah. So in terms of what they want from the city or the police, a lot of them are asking for a defunding of the police department, or at least not give them any more funds. And then yesterday, Black Lives Matter put out a statement, I think it was alongside the ACLU, asking for a few other things. They basically wanted the police department to admit that it has a problem with racism. They want more focus on de-escalation. And then they want all the charges for protesters to be dropped. They also want them to stop using rubber bullets for protesters. That was a big thing, especially on Saturday and Monday's protest. A lot of people got hit with rubber bullets, and I mean, you see the pictures of the people with those wounds, and I mean, they're not minor. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they're minor compared to a real bullet. You know, but it hurts people, and so they're asking for that. And just from what they're asking from, you know, people who attend these protests, or you know, just maybe supporters or something, is I think they've just been calling again and again for people to just educate themselves, because I think their idea is once people teach themselves about the systemic racism in this country and everything going around nationwide and locally in our communities, they think that people will probably come around and see things their way. And so they're hoping that if people will just take the time to Google and stuff like that, maybe their jobs won't be so hard.
Hey, Peyton, what have the protests these past few nights been like? I mean, maybe you can highlight some of the moments that stuck out to you as you watched this all unfold, because you were, walking around a lot with the protesters who marched from place to place. What have they been like?
Yeah, It's been kind of not fun, but just I think it's been good that I've been there, myself most of the nights and not had different people kind of come in, because I've gotten a chance to see how these protests have kind of evolved. And so earlier in the week, I mean, they weren't necessarily small. I mean, they were big gatherings, but you look at, the number of people that were there, Tuesday versus how many people were out last night, and it's hundreds versus thousands of people. And so, I mean, the movement is growing, but something that I've also noticed is that, on Saturday there was a lot of people with very, kind of anti-police sentiments. I mean, an acronym I saw graffitied on most surfaces was this thing, ACAB, which is all cops are bad. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say what the actual B word is on the radio, but
you know, I don't know either. So we'll leave it. Yeah. It's a different word.
And so there were all these, there was all that kind of anti-police sentiment. But as the protests have gone on, the people who have kind of decided to lead these protests, and I should mention, I mean, they're not all the time organized protests where there's a point person. Sometimes it's very organic. And so these people that have decided to take the megaphone and make speeches have all been most have been talking about the need to not, don't necessarily make this about police. This is our movement. We don't need to spend our time yelling at police. They've called for nonviolence on, I think it was Wednesday's protest. It literally started, the organizers started with a march where everybody clapped and yelled peaceful protest, And I think just the sheer number of people that have shown up have really been what's with me, and last night, there were 2,000 people who came out, and for the first 3 hours of this event, everybody literally just sat around and listened to a series of all Black speakers that came out to just kind of give their perspective, on the movement. And if the goal is to educate people, I mean, 3 hours of perspective is a good first step.
Wow. There was also this moment, and this isn't the same as being educated. It's more of an action of a symbolic action, a moment of demonstration. There was this moment in the protest, and I can't remember if it was in yesterday's or in previous days, and it was actually probably multiple occasions, but you described this action where protesters laid down on the ground for 8 minutes. Tell us why that happened, Peyton.
Yeah. And that's another change, too, because at first the big kind of group demonstration was a kneel. You know, we're going to take a knee for George Floyd. But then activists here had kind of been grumbling, saying, you know, the person who was kneeling in the George Floyd case was the officer. You know, why would we want to, you know, symbolize that? Mm-hmm. And so now activists have been calling for demonstrators to actually lay on the ground. A lot of people put their hands behind their back like they're handcuffed, and they'll just lay there for eight minutes, which was approximately the amount of time that George Floyd had to lay there with that officer's knee in his neck. And the point is, according to these demonstrators, is to give people a sense of how long 8 minutes really is. Because, and I think I tweeted this the other night, it's like you hear 8 minutes and you say, oh, you know, not even 10 minutes. That's not a huge amount of time. But when you're in the moment, just laying there on the ground, I mean, it gets uncomfortable and it feels like a while, you know.
Did you do that as well? I mean, did you participate, or were you, you know, just only watching as an observer, or did you lay down on the ground? And if you did, what was it like for you?
I didn't lay down on the ground. I've been trying to find some kind of balance between being at these protests and right. not actually participating in them, you know, and so it's like I try to get out of the way. I don't want to be the person that's standing up in the middle of the crowd, you know, but
sure.
I mean, it's astounding when you're out there and, you know, you're so used to hearing, you know, the movement of hundreds of people walking down the street, you know, their sign shuffling, their call and response chants and stuff like that. And then it's just silent, you know, just the feat of getting all those people to do one thing is, I don't know, it's impressive to see.
Hmm. Peyton, we're gonna head to a break here soon, and when we come back, we're going to turn from the protests to some other angles, including some efforts at listening by elected officials, which kind of returns to the theme of Robert Gerke's column. But is there anything else that you want to highlight from the nightly protests since that initial one? I mean, one of the things that's been interesting to me is the geography of the protests, how far mm-hmm. you have walked. But what else do you want to highlight?
I think the sheer miles walked is wild. I've been kind of posting my stats at the end of every night, and they average around 5 miles. But another thing that sticks out to me is, especially when you have these protests up at the Capitol, is the fact that it's still closed, you know? And so you show up and you're not allowed on the grounds where people normally protest. And then you just see, you know, National Guardsmen positioned with, you know, their rifles in between the cherry blossoms. And it's just such a strange sight to see. And just the juxtaposition of that with all the people there. And sometimes they have this chant that goes, why are you in riot gear? I don't see a riot here. Hmm. And just, I don't know, just that scene sticks with me.
Robert Gerke, news columnist, you know, some groups like Alliance for Better Utah have asked for the governor to recall the National Guard, and others have said this is an overreaction to, you know, to protest. But I mean, what do you think about how big that response has been from the governor and from city leaders and so on?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we could talk a little bit about Mayor Mendenhall's order to impose a curfew on Salt Lake for a week is what it initially was.
Right.
That got a little pushback because it was viewed as stifling the protesters' free speech. And I think she eventually capitulated and backed down on that after a couple of days or nights, I guess. You know, that was probably a little bit of an overreaction, although, you know, at the time she did it, she didn't know what to expect. So I think she was probably reacting to the worst case potential. You know, I think the you were talking about the reforms that are being asked for.
We'll get to that in a second, actually, Robert, after the break. But I'm mostly interested in your comments on the National Guard on Salt Lake City streets. I mean, was that a necessary move?
You know, it's hard to say. I wasn't down there, so Peyton probably has a better perspective on it. But it seems like, you know, we're seeing our police departments militarized in ways that we haven't in the past. It's very hard to distinguish between, you know, law enforcement and the National Guard. And so there was a pretty strong showing of force to try to, you know, restore order before things got even more out of hand. It's always hard to find a balance, I guess, between, you know, trying to protect people's safety and as well as protecting property, and then being oppressive. It's a hard balance. I think there's probably some dissection and reflection that will need to go on there, before we do have these sorts of incidents in the future, because we will. I don't have a real
got it
firm view of that.
Okay. As I said, we were going to head to our first break in the show, but as we do, we're going to play the sounds of some of the protest from yesterday, stolen mainly from Peyton Harkin's Twitter feed. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back after these sounds and then a quick break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Peyton Harkins and Taylor Stevens and news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. All right, well, before the break, we were talking about the protests, the mass movements to try to get change to happen, changes in policing and in policies, in society. There have been some statements and meetings and community gatherings convened by elected officials in the midst of all of this. For example, Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall convened a community conversation between Black leaders and the Salt Lake City Police Department. Media got to come in at the end of that meeting, and we heard that it was to some extent a listening exercise, but that also prominent Black leaders in the community were given a kind of rundown of the city's procedures for restraint and use of force. I want to turn to another listening session that was convened by Utah Governor Gary Herbert in just a moment. But first, I want to play a clip from the Salt Lake City event held at the Public Safety Building, where windows are still broken from Saturday's protest. This is Representative Sandra Hollins, Utah's only Black state lawmaker. She's speaking to me and other reporters in a media availability just after that meeting with police and city leaders came to a close. And she had her own comments about listening and being heard, speaking of that topic. Take a listen.
So, and I hope I don't mess this up, but there's an African proverb that says that if the youth don't feel the warmth of the community, they're going to create their own fire. And I think that's what's going on. I think our youth are not feeling that they're being heard. And this is a part of that consequences of them not being heard. I am a part of minority legislators who have been getting together, and we've been having these conversations about how do we move forward, what policy changes do need to happen in this state to move us forward, what conversations need to happen. And so we are working on coming up with those policies and action items, and part of what we want to do is listen to the community and listen to these young people and see what their thoughts are. We understand they're frustrated, we understand their anger, and we want to be that listening ear. It has to start with listening. We have to listen. They have a lot to say, and they need an avenue to be able to say it.
And again, State Democratic Representative Sandra Hollins, Utah's only Black state lawmaker. And that was at an event, a community conversation that was convened by Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall on Tuesday. And I'll just mention that everyone was masked up. Taylor Stevens, you were at another listening session of sorts, a meeting of the state's multicultural and Martin Luther King Jr. commissions that happened the day after that on Wednesday. Tell us about this meeting. Where was it? Who was there? Maybe you can set the scene for us.
Yes, so this meeting took place at the state capitol on Wednesday, and members of the commissions, also members of the Black community, and there are people who were there in person, there are people who were online, and a lot of public comment. Unlike in a lot of public meetings, they didn't have any limitations. Public entities will say, okay, 2 minutes per comment, and then we'll cut you off and go to the next person. They gave everybody time to speak for as long as they wanted to, and people did, you know, try to keep their remarks short so that they could allow others to speak. But, you know, it was a very, very much a listening session as far as, you know, people speaking, members of the Black community speaking about the injustices that they face, sharing personal stories about their interactions with police or their systemic racism that they have faced. And they also provided policymakers with some specific ideas for how they could address systemic racism. This meeting, I believe, was only supposed to be about an hour and a half, but Governor Herbert canceled his meeting with Vice President Mike Pence so that he could stay and listen. And they spoke for over 2 hours during the meeting.
You described this moment also where the governor, after having listened to some of the stories of injustice that people were describing, that he kind of choked up. Is that right?
Yeah, he did get emotional, but I'd kind of like to focus on, if we could, some of the things that the Black members of the community were bringing forward and some of the policy ideas that they spoke about.
Absolutely.
So what they were presenting is, you know, they want to see educational requirements, new requirements for officers, such as ongoing bias and diversity training. Currently, officers are required to do 18 hours. They'd like to see more. They also want officers to be taught more de-escalation principles. Karen Johnson, who's a member of the Martin Luther King Commission, also an associate professor at the University of Utah, is proposing an officer database to track bad cops, or kind of quote-unquote bad cops, so they can't go somewhere else to perpetuate the same behavior. But they also, you know, beyond police reform, talked about, you know, how do we get more people of color in leadership roles? How do we get more people of color into the classroom? How do we teach young people about racism and systemic inequalities so that we're in a better chance to, you know, fix those throughout the years? But another thing that they spoke about is they've been talking about these things for a long time. It isn't like, you know, this protest blew up and they suddenly had all these ideas. Members of the Black community have been bringing forward this demand for change for a long time, and nothing's happened. And so they mentioned, you know, the bill is due, and we want to see some actual change, and we need to see some change quickly. We don't want to have conversations anymore. We don't want to talk about racism anymore. We want to do something that will actually, you know, work towards fixing these systemic inequities. And so that was a major thread throughout the comments from the Black community, that they actually want to see some change, and they're demanding some change now.
One of the things, I'm not certain you mentioned this, but another demand was having people in leadership roles who are people of color. Can you talk about that demand?
Yeah, exactly. And part of that, as I mentioned, is, you know, getting people into the classroom. Adrian Andrews, a member of the commission, said racism and hate are taught. And so we need to provide educators with the tools to help people understand these concepts and work through them with students in their classroom. So starting young, so that, you know, somebody's first exposure to these concepts comes through their education, and that they're able to address some of the systemic inequalities a little bit better as a result of that. So this meeting ended without any really concrete or specific commitments from the governor or the lieutenant governor. They said that they were there to listen and engage in a dialogue. The governor, as you mentioned, did get emotional talking about, you know, his understanding that he has a large responsibility here. And he says he does want to do something, that this is all kind of futile if something isn't done. He's committed to looking at police reform to weed out, you know, officers who are not kind of engaging in the right way. And he's also promised to examine the state budget to see if there's room for investment in some programs. However, he's kind of insinuated that might be tough because, as we've reported, there is a big need for slashes to state programs as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. But members of the Black community, I think they ended the meeting, you know, 30 days, we'll come back and hopefully get some more specifics. But Emma Houston, who's the chairwoman of the Martin Luther King Commission, said, you know, we're done with conversations, we're about action, and we're going to hold these lawmakers accountable for actually doing something.
You know, Taylor, there's been, I mean, it's one of the things that protesters have been asking for across the nation, really, has been this idea of defunding the police, as Peyton mentioned earlier. In Minneapolis, they are talking about kind of dismantling the police department, and I don't mean like protesters are talking about that. I mean the city council of Minneapolis is talking about doing that, and I think that will probably end up being something like a restructuring or a reordering, but you know, maybe changing the function of police. Systemic racism, institutional racism, obviously isn't just a problem with cops. It's all over, and that's why it's called systemic. But the focus right now is on police. Is there any kind of conversation like that happening with what Black leaders in Utah are bringing to people like the governor?
You know, there's a lot of conversations happening that didn't come up in this meeting with the governor, but on the local level, as Peyton mentioned, there are people calling for Salt Lake City Council to defund the police or not give more money. We also have a story up today. I reported yesterday on South Salt Lake. They're exploring creating an independent citizen police review board. So I think that, you know, organizers are working at all levels of government trying to bring forward change to the local level, municipal level, working at the state level. I'm sure we'll see, you know, some kind of effort at the county level. The counties sometimes run unified police departments. So, you know, this is something that I think we're seeing across the board, and I think leaders are just hoping that something sticks.
Taylor, just on that South Salt Lake idea of making a civilian review board, an independent civilian review board, isn't there a state law that kind of prohibits that from happening?
So there is a state law related to civilian review boards. Utah municipalities have the power to create them, but they're not allowed to give them much power, and they're not allowed to provide them the ability to discipline officers. So you can have a police review board that's maybe providing recommendations for disciplining an officer, but they don't have that power themselves. And that was passed in 2019 in response to a 2018 proposal from Utah Against Police Brutality, which held the rally on Saturday. And they were pushing the Salt Lake City Council to replace its current review board with one that had more power to strike down policies, veto police chief, veto new rules, and things like that. So they don't have a ton of power, but, you know, it's in some people's eyes better than nothing.
And sorry, just to clarify here, the South Salt Lake Independent Civilian Review Board, would that run counter to that law, or would that fall within, you know, under the dictates of that law?
It would fall under the dictates of that law, yeah. But it's in its really early phases, and so we don't know exactly what it would look like, but it doesn't seem like they're trying to do anything outside of the bounds of current state law.
Okay. Boy, Robert Gerke, news columnist, I don't know even what to ask you here on, you know, there's that state law, but there's also the idea of trying to reform police altogether. You know, and the changes that people are asking for at a systemic level and changes in leadership and, you know, a massive overhaul. I mean, we're talking about revolutionary changes that people have been clamoring for quite a while and, you know, have been thwarted at every turn. What's your take here? How do you want to dive into this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of hit on an important piece of this at the end there. That these are things that people have been talking about for years, and, you know, they're not necessarily new ideas, but there does seem to be a little bit more willingness to move on them right now. You know, first and foremost, I think the listening component of this is a crucial piece of it. But second, you know, we are seeing an urgency to act, I think, and it's I think that's encouraging. The NAACP today is, right as we wrap up the show, is going to be having a news conference up at the Capitol where they're going to be announcing some legislative efforts. Minority members of the legislature, notably, who have not been necessarily included in that process as much as maybe they should, but are also in the process of listening to the community and fashioning numerous pieces of legislation. So, you know, we're probably going to see some action. I mean, the NAACP is asking for a ban on chokeholds statewide, which, as I understand it, is already state policy, but they want it encoded into the law. The Civilian Review Board, they want to give them some actual authority rather than making them more advisory. There's de-escalation. They want uniform de-escalation policies around the state, which is my understanding, again, that Salt Lake City already has, but they want to see it encoded into law and formalized. And then they want to see the practice of shielding police complaints from the public done away with. And so, you know, we're seeing some potential steps that I think there seems to be a lot of support for taking right now. But again, it was pointed out that in Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, they already had most of these steps in place, and it still happened. So it also kind of goes to a larger issue of, I was talking to some black leaders this week, and the institutions don't change until the people do. And so, you know, that kind of takes us back to the listening component of this, the understanding, and hopefully changing ourselves so we can change our community.
We need to head to a break here in just a moment, but Taylor Stephens, just on the meeting convened by Governor Herbert and the changes that people are requesting, do you have anything to add here before we head to our final break in the show? Sorry, Taylor, anything to add there? I think I lost you.
I think we've covered it. Thank you.
Okay, got it. Perfect. All right, we're going to head to a quick break in the show, and when we come back, there's still more from this past week's news, including a pandemic that is happening, in case you forgot. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Peyton Harkins, Taylor Stephens, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can call us at 801-355-8255 to join this conversation. That's 801-355-8255. Talk. And as I mentioned before the break, you know, all of this upheaval and drive for change is happening in the midst of a deadly pandemic. And it's a pandemic that is not going away of its own accord. In fact, you could even say it's kind of coming back. Taylor Stephens, this isn't your reporting, I know, but I know that you are following it. State epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn says that there is a sharp spike in cases here in the state of Utah. Tell us what she means or I guess how bad of a spike we are talking about.
Yeah, this was reported by my colleague Sean Means, and just to give a couple numbers, on Thursday we had 316 new diagnoses. We haven't gotten the numbers for today quite yet, and that's 8 days in a row that the state has reported jumps of more than 200 cases. And at the state's press conference on Wednesday talking about the coronavirus, their weekly update, Dr. Angela Dunn, the state's epidemiologist, she mentioned, you know, that this sharp spike is not necessarily the result of a single outbreak or an increase in testing. Rather, this is a statewide trend that we're seeing of increased coronavirus cases. And, you know, partially that's with the state reopening a lot of things, I think she mentioned that we're seeing a lot of cases, outbreaks are beginning in places of business where people are in close contact indoors. That follows national trends, she says. But, you know, that's, we're kind of starting to see the results of the reopening that we started at the beginning of last month.
That's interesting that she pointed out that this specifically is not the result of increased testing. And we can also rule out, you know, this having anything to do with protests, because it's too early for that to have kind of been showing up in the results and the increase in results. You know, all of this is coming, and maybe I'll turn this to the news columnist for an opinion, but this comes after I can't remember the name of the group, but the sort of economic task force on COVID-19 recommended that the state of Utah make a kind of preliminary move to the green level or low risk level here for coronavirus, which would allow an even further opening of the state. Robert Gehrke, I'm wondering if the question shouldn't be, hey, should we move back into a more heightened risk level given the spike we're seeing?
Yeah, the Legislative Commission this week said that they would like to see, or they recommended the governor move to what they called smart green, which is a vague thing, but, you know, it's presumably something that's a little bit more narrowly tailored to specific communities and counties. There are counties that are not being affected as drastically as, you know, the urban counties in the state. But, you know, this is the governor's office initially laid out four metrics that for going first to orange, then to yellow. And right now, it seems like the state's not meeting any of those metrics. We're seeing hospitalizations increasing. We're seeing the rate of transmission increasing. We're seeing the numbers of cases increasing. We're seeing more community spread, which is spread, you know, not because one of the encouraging signs was that people who are contracting the disease were either getting it from a housemate, a family member, or something like that. We're seeing more community spread now. It's hard to see any measurement at all that is positive right now since we've loosened these restrictions. In fact, we've gone from fairly moderate growth of the disease to accelerated spread. I guess maybe the one encouraging sign is that there's our hospitalization capacity, or we still have quite a bit of room in the hospitals. But, the fact that the governor's weighing this going to green is kind of a startling thought right now. Dr. Angela Dunn was asked at her press conference what public health officials thought, and she said right now public health is recommending we don't go to green. In the past week alone, we had almost 1,900 new cases, which is a huge jump from where we were a week earlier. So, we kind of expected this. Doctors I talked to, epidemiologists I talked to, even public health, Dr. Dunn said that we expected an increase as we started trying to go back to a more normal life. But we've also, I think, all seen people who don't wear masks, people who are congregating together. We saw these protests. I think those are, we'll see cases come out of that. The group that's pushing to reopen the economy completely has tried to have a Colin Ray concert up in Kaysville, then in Tooele. Now it's scheduled down in Cedar City. So, we're not out of the woods yet. We're trying to find the right balance, I guess, on how to live with this virus in our midst. But it's hard to see that we're there yet.
You know, with that, we are going to wrap it up here just in the interest of time and head to our final segment of the show, which is the underplayed stories of the week. And Peyton Harkins, if we've still got you on the line, we haven't heard from you in quite a while. Do you have a pick? Do you have a pick for underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, I do. This actually happened last night. There was, while I was out covering the protest rallying against police shootings and police brutality, there was another police shooting in Provo, and we don't have that many details about it, but a woman was apparently pointing a gun at police at a state park, and they shot her, and she survived, I'm pretty sure, but I haven't gotten an update on her condition. But Just with the focus on the recent protests, mainly being, you know, the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor elsewhere, I think it's important for people to remember that, you know, this kind of violence is happening in our communities in Utah. You know, 2018, I wrote the story about police killing 19 people and shooting at 30 here in Utah, and the attorney general launched an inquiry into that. And so, you know, just as our, you know, our focus might be on, you know, things happening nationally, just remember these are issues that very much affect people in Utah.
Okay. Peyton Harkins with her pick for Underplayed Story of the Week, a recent police shooting. Robert Gerke, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Yeah, just quickly, I'm going to plug Aaron Alberti's reporting on Test Utah, the ongoing scrutiny that is about the validity of their tests and whether there's shortcomings in the lab work. And just secondly, if I could pivot real quick, there were numerous debates last week for the upcoming Republican primaries, and I think, you know, normally this is the political time where we're getting into the political season for the primaries. The attorney general debate in particular was pretty fiery and worth watching. So you can find those find audio and or video of those debates on sltrib.com.
Great. Thanks, Robert, for your picks. And Taylor Stevens, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Yeah, I want to highlight some reporting my colleague Lee Davidson did about the Kaysville City Council. This saga goes back a few weeks, but Kaysville Mayor Katie Witt, who is running for the 1st Congressional District, had supported a protest concert over coronavirus restrictions. The council ended up shutting that down. The concerts moved several times, but the latest on this is that the City Council last night issued a letter of censure to Mayor Witt. They didn't call for her resignation, but several council members said if she wants to offer it, they would fully support that.
Okay. Really interesting turn in that story and ongoing reporting on that from the Salt Lake Tribune. For my part, I'll just read a headline, which is that a gray wolf is in Utah for the first time in years. The state is setting traps. That kind of encapsulate the story. You can find that. You can read about that in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune or at sltrib.com, where you can find everything else that we have been discussing on the program today. Peyton Harkins, Taylor Stevens, and Robert Gerke, all with the Tribune. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
That does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.